Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line this evening our good friend Bill Federer, and we're going to be talking about, is there really a St. Nicholas? And, you know, Christmas is just, well, less than a week away. Most of our programs we hear on television, most of what we read in the newspapers and magazines, it doesn't have anything to do with Christmas. In fact, we've almost taken the Christ completely out of Christmas. We've replaced him with Santa Claus and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and It's a Wonderful Life. And but there really is a background for what we believe and for this holiday and why we have a somebody called St. Nicholas. And so Bill is, first of all, you should know a little bit about him. He's run twice for Congress. He's going to be running again for Dick Gephardt's seat there and in the St. Louis area. And this time, I bet he's going to make it, and he's going to be going back to Washington, D.C. But he's written a number of books we carry. And if you have not read his book, America's God and Country, why you've missed one of the most important books we have going into the background of America's Christian heritage. And there's a CD that goes with that. And then there's another book on America's Minute, I guess it is. I have it sitting right here, America's God and Country. It's sort of something for every day. And then he's written books on St. Patrick and on St. Nicholas. And so we're going to be talking this. Oh, and of course, George Washington Carver. You don't want to miss that one at all. Right now, we want to talk to Bill about St. Nicholas. Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, good evening, Stan. Great to be with you.
Well, I think in lieu of it's Christmas season, I think people really ought to know who St. Nicholas is. We equate him with Santa Claus, and yet, of course, there's a very real historical figure behind all of this, isn't there?
Well, there is, and it all started in 280 A.D. in Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, and this was during the Roman Empire period. There was born in the city of Patara, P-A-T-A-R-A, a baby named Nicholas. And his parents were elderly and wealthy. And by the time he had grown to a teenager, a plague had swept through that area, and his parents had died and left him a large amount of wealth. And Nicholas's uncle was a pastor in a neighboring city, and encouraged Nicholas in a spiritual direction, and so he began to be very generous with this wealth that he had inherited, giving to the poor and helping those that were in need. And one story that became very popular was how a merchant in town in Patara went bankrupt. And back then, the creditors would come and take not only your house and your lands, but your children. Sort of like debtor's prison, only worse. And this merchant had three beautiful daughters, and he knew if they were taken by the creditors, they would probably end up with an unfortunate life of prostitution. So he thought if he could hurry up and marry his daughters off, then the creditors couldn't take him. But unfortunately, he didn't have money for a dowry, which was needed back then for a legally recognized wedding. Well, Nicholas heard the problem, and one night threw a bag of gold in the window, and it landed supposedly in a shoe that was drying by the fireplace, and the oldest daughter was able to get married. It was the talk of the town. It was a buzz. And a few weeks later, he did it for the second daughter and finally did it for the third daughter. The dad had wised up and ran outside at night and caught Nicholas. And Nicholas made him promise not to tell where the money came from. And so that started the origin of a secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which was December 6th. So people would give the gifts and have the packages wrapped, and nobody would know who they came from. You know, well, that all started with Nicholas being the unnamed gift giver to help out that merchant. Anyway, Nicholas was a real person, and he went on to become the Bishop of Myra in Asia Minor. And most of the history goes back to the Eastern Orthodox Church, because that was the area of the world where he lived. And so some of the stories that I have put in my book are from the Eastern Orthodox tradition, and I give them the footnote and the credit for them. And, you know, there's no way of knowing exactly what's fact and what was legend added on, but I thought it's at least important to know what the history that has been passed down for the centuries was. And one of those is that Nicholas at one point decided to take a trip to North Africa, which was a Christian center there in Alexandria for centuries. And anyway, he was caught in a storm, and the storm was so terrible that he vowed that if he got back home to Asia Minor, that he would make a pilgrimage to a church, which was not uncommon back then. And so he finally made it back to Myra, the capital city, and he went ashore. It was early in the morning, to the big cathedral there. Well, unbeknownst to him, the archbishop of all of Asia Minor had died, and all the local bishops had gathered together to vote on a new one, and they couldn't decide, and it went on and on. They couldn't decide who the replacement was going to be. Well, the eldest one there, 80 years old, supposedly had a dream that the first person that came to church early that morning would be the new replacement archbishop. And so when Nicholas walks in the door, it's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's the first one there. And the elderly leader, church leader, meets him and asks him his name and brings him before the assembly, and they choose him as their next archbishop. Well, it took him a little while to give into it, but he did. And it's important to realize back then, being a church leader was not just an honor, it was a danger, because this is during the Roman era of persecution of Christians. Sort of like, you know, the who wants to volunteer, and everybody else steps back, and you're the left one left standing in front. So Diocletian was the Roman emperor at the time, and he had a persecution of Christians that was particularly terrible. There were 10 major persecutions of Christians in the first 300 years of Christianity, and the worst was the 10th. It was the last one. Diocletian actually erected a monument to the extermination of Christianity and would go systematically province by province, rounding up the church leaders and killing them and burning the churches and, you know, putting the Christians in prison. And, well, when he came to Asia Minor, Nicholas was the most prominent Christian leader now, because being the archbishop, so he really didn't have anywhere to hide. And yes, he was caught and put in prison awaiting death for 2 years. And but during that time, Diocletian, the emperor, was struck with an intestinal disease. Back then, the Roman emperors had declared themselves a god. It's funny because Diocletian's disease was so painful that he abdicated his throne. He stepped down from being emperor. So if you can picture somebody stepping down from being a god, you know, of course, he wasn't, but he thought he was. And he went to farm in Yugoslavia, Diocletian did. Well, the next emperor took over, Gaius, and he died of that same intestinal disease. Must have been something in the water there in Rome, I don't know. And then back then, the soldiers in the armies would swear allegiance to their general, not to the country. Like we pledge allegiance to the flag, back then it was I pledge allegiance to my general. So when an emperor would die, the generals that were there would look around and see who had the biggest army, and whoever did would declare himself the next emperor. Well, there were 4 generals, and 2 of them were eliminated, so it was finally down to Constantine and Maxentius. And Constantine was about to attack, and a couple days before the battle, he looked up in the sky, and the story is that he saw the sign of Christ, which was the P with the X underneath of it, that Greek symbol. And he put that on all of his shields and symbols, and the words were in hoc signa vinces, which means in this sign you'll be invincible, you'll win. And it, sure enough, Constantine won. And so in 313 A.D., he responded by legalizing Christianity for the first time in history, that now it was no longer a crime to be a Christian. And he let Nicholas out of prison. So Nicholas had been in prison 2 years. He was let out by Constantine and went back to Myra, was restored as the bishop. And back then, there was a guy named Arius who was going around saying Jesus was a little less than God, so he started this Arian heresy. Well, it got so heated that the Roman emperor himself, Constantine, orders all the bishops to come to Nicaea, which was just a few hundred miles from Myra, Asia Minor, where Nicholas was, and to have the Council of Nicaea to settle this heresy once and for all. Well, anyway, Arius was there, and he shared his views, which Nicholas was so upset at that Nicholas slapped him across the face on the floor of the conference. So Nicholas had a fiery temper to him. And anyway, Arius, his views were put out, and they, in place, came up with the doctrine of the Trinity. They established it there, and they came up with the Nicene Creed, which is said today in churches all across the world still, especially in Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox traditions. Anyway, Nicholas went back to Myra, and now that Christianity was legal, he began to preach against paganism. So he preached against Diana, who was the fertility goddess there at Ephesus, and helped tear down the temple to Diana. Those that are familiar with the Bible, the Apostle Paul went to Ephesus and began to preach and cut back on the idol traffic, and the idol makers got so upset that they caused a riot and got all these people in the stadium to chant, "Great is Diana, the goddess of the Ephesians." And so it was that same Diana temple that St. Nicholas helped tear down. So he was a real person. He took his faith seriously. And some of the stories that I included in the book, and again, the title of the book is There Really is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Tradition. Some of the stories that are in there, you don't know how much is fact and how much is legend, but I at least wanted to put them in, you know, inside the Greek Orthodox Church as the, you know, the source of these stories. One was that Myra, being a port city, that the storms were often terrible, and one time the storms were particularly terrible, so much so that the sailors thought they were going to drown, and all the people on shore were certain that, you know, their loved ones, the sailors were going to die out in the ocean. And so they got Nicholas to come down to the dock, and he prayed, and the story is the sea became calm, and the sailors were able to come back and dock and come back safely. Another story was a famine was in that area of Asia Minor, and Nicholas went down to the dock and talked some of the ships that were bound for North Africa to unload some of their cargo, some of their grain, to feed his people, and promised them that by the time they reached their final destination that the Lord would bless them back. And sure enough, on their return trip, they said that the grain had multiplied in the hull of their ship, and they had plenty when they reached their destination. And anyway, there's a fair amount of stories like that, and some of them are a little harder to believe than others, but you know, nevertheless, they did have an origin, that there was really a person named Nicholas, and he was very popular, was the bishop there at Myra. And when he died, the gift-giving part became a big deal. Matter of fact, he was so popular that there are more churches named after Nicholas in the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox traditions, more churches named after Nicholas than anybody else other than Mary. So he was very popular. When Vladimir the Great, the emperor of Russia, came down to Constantinople in the 9th century, he converted to Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and he adopted Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. That's why there's so many people in Russia with, you know, Nikolai or Nicholas is their name. Nicholas was basically an Eastern Mediterranean personage until the Muslims swept through in the 11th century. And the Muslims came through Asia Minor and would kill the Christians and turn the churches into mosques. And the seven churches mentioned in the last book in the Bible, the book of Revelation, those seven churches, the church of Philadelphia and Laodicea and Sardis, and the Apostle John writes these letters, all seven of those churches were wiped out by the Muslims. You know, the Muslim faith started in Saudi Arabia in the 7th century, and there were 130 Catholic dioceses along northern Africa, and they were all wiped out within a few hundred years after Islam started. The word Islam means submission, and if you submit, you are a must-Islam, you are a Muslim, and if you don't submit, then you die. And it would be similar to, you know, Muhammad and his army, and they charged into Medina and conquered it, and whoever didn't submit died, and whoever did, they said, "Well, get your horse and get your sword and follow us to the next town." And so then they go to the next town, they ride in there, and they say, "Submit or die," and if you didn't submit, you died, and if you did submit, they say, "Get your horse and your sword and follow us to the next town." So it sort of just grew and grew and grew, and finally swept through North Africa, swept through all of Palestine area. You know, in 636 A.D., is when Jerusalem finally fell to the Muslims. It was a four-month bloody siege, and finally the Byzantine Christian bishop stood on the walls of the city and surrendered it to the Muslims. And But it was in the 11th century that the Muslims swept through all of Asia Minor, which is where Nicholas is, was, and all the people. And so when the Muslims started getting closer to Myra, which was that capital city, the people there dug up the bones of Nicholas, and again, he was their most famous person. He was like their George Washington. And they dug up his bones, and they sent them over to Bari, Italy, B-A-R-I, Bari, Italy, and his bones are still in a cathedral to this day in Bari, Italy, the bones of Nicholas. And so there was a break between Eastern Europe and Western Europe, Eastern being the Eastern Orthodox Christianity and Western being Roman Catholic. And so for the Eastern Orthodox people to send their most famous person, the bones of the most famous person, to Western Europe was a big act of reconciliation. It made a big statement in Europe at the time. Anyway, so when Nicholas's bones were in Bari, Italy, it introduced Western Europe to the traditions of Nicholas and gift-giving, and it became so popular that Francis of Assisi, in the third Francis of Assisi in 1223, sort of in protest, came up with the nativity scene. The Jesus, Mary, Joseph, donkeys in a manger, and, you know, Francis of Assisi was saying, look, we need to get back to the reason for the season, and that reason is that Jesus was born in a manger. He was, you know, God came to earth as man. And so that's the origins of the nativity scene, the crash scene. Anyway, Martin Luther did a similar thing in Germany, and he ended all the acknowledging of saints and all the saints' days, and so that included Saint Nicholas, December 6th. That was his feast day. And so, but the, you know, the people liked the holiday, and so Nicholas introduced Kris Kringle sort of as a replacement, and Kris Kringle is German for Christ child. Kris meaning Christ, and Kringle, the Germans pronounce child Kindle in people, kindergarten, but people had trouble saying Kindle, and it ended up changing to Kringle. So Kris Kringle meant Christ child in Germany. Then in England, Henry VIII brought the Reformation there, but not because he had a spiritual experience. It was because he wanted another wife, and the Pope said no, and he said, the heck with you, I'll be my own Pope, and he ended up having six wives, and their fates were divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived, so Henry was not a really nice guy to be married to. Anyway, Henry ended all the acknowledging of saints and all the saints' days in England, and so December 6th, which was St. Nicholas's feast day, there was no St. Nicholas anymore, and so there was no purpose for December 6th anymore. But the people liked the gift-giving and the holiday because they had celebrated it for centuries. And so he moved all that celebration stuff to December 25th, which up until that time had basically just been a religious service to honor the birth of Christ. That was the date picked back in the 354 A.D. By Pope Labienus. So it was, you know, Henry VIII that changed the December 25th day from a religious service to, in England, all the festivities. If you go to continental Europe, especially, you know, in Germany and Holland, they still have all their gift-giving on December 6th. That's the date that they have their traditions of St. Nicholas and so forth. And in Holland, to this day, the December 25th is basically just a religious service. They don't give gifts on that date. Anyway, it was in England. Since there was no saints anymore, there could not be any St. Nicholas, but again, the people liked the holiday so much that Henry VIII basically reintroduced an old Roman holiday of Saturnalia. You have to remember that Britain was a Roman colony. And as such, at the end of the year, they had their winter solstice, and they celebrated Saturn, who was their god of feasting and plenty and merriment and gift-giving. And he was pictured as a big fat guy with green robes, a wreath in his hair, a goblet of wine, grapes all around, ho, ho, ho. And if you saw the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens, the spirit of Christmas present, the happy party type guy, that's how they pictured the Saturnalia guy, but instead they overlaid him and they began to call him Father Christmas. And so that was the origins of Father Christmas in England.
All right, I'm going to ask you to sort of hold that thought. We're going to have to take a little break here, and when we get back, we'll go along with more of these wonderful ideas that you're expressing here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and, of course, our guest this evening is William Federer, who's going to be running for Congress. And we're going to have an opportunity to hear the rest of the story, but while our listeners up in the Great Northwest are going to be hearing some commercial announcements, let me ask Bill, how is your race for Congress going?
Oh, it's going great, Stan, and we're getting support from people all across the country. We have a website, Federer.
Go ahead and put it out.
It's www.federer04, and that's FEDERER04.org. And we got people contributing, and this is really a tremendous opportunity to win this seat and make a tremendous statement by defeating Gebhardt and taking his seat by a Republican. It basically is a referendum on the entire agenda that he stood for. And so, this, again, most congressional seats don't change hands, from Democrat to Republican or vice versa. They don't change hands unless they're an open seat because the incumbent has so much, power. But Gebhardt, with running for president, has indicated that he's not planning on running for re-election to Congress. And so this basically means it's an open seat. And I've gotten the most votes ever against Gebhardt in history the last time I ran against him. So, this is a perfect situation where, we're running, we have the name recognition, we have the support, and we're just believing that this is the time that we're going to get in.
Well, I certainly hope and pray that that's the case, because we need people who fear God in Washington, D.C. And one of the problems we have back there is I don't think most of our representatives have any fear of God at all. I think that they sort of just go ahead and do whatever they want to. And I was reading an editorial by Bob Barr in the Washington Times today. Of course, he was back there in Washington, D.C. For many years. And he was talking about how that all the Republicans would get together. And they were discussing the McCain-Feingold bill, which, as you recall, was supposedly designed to prevent soft money donations to the political parties by our major corporations. But they had the contingency there that no organization, political organization, nobody could really run ads for giving the voting record of congressmen, giving the voting record of somebody who was up for election within, I think, 6 weeks of the election. In other words, it stopped people, organizations from telling, like Gun Owners of America, from telling the people who are going to be voting for a congressman their congressman's voting record. And the excuse that was given back, according to Bob Barr, was a lot of the congressmen said, well, it's a terrible thing, we shouldn't vote for this. But the Supreme Court will never allow this to stand, this restriction of the right of freedom of speech. After all, it's unconstitutional, so we'll go ahead and vote for it. Well, they went ahead and voted for it, and lo and behold, the Supreme Court fooled them. The Supreme Court went right along, violated the Constitution, says it's all right to limit freedom of speech before an election so people can't find out how their congressman voted. Well, this makes you feel that we got an awful lot of congressmen back there who don't believe in much of anything. They're just going to do what's politically expedient. And now, of course, the great corporations have found other means of giving money to the political parties. So all we've really done is violated the Constitution, restricted freedom of speech, and it's because we had people who really weren't men of principle back in Washington, D.C. So remember that website. It's Federer04.org, because I know Bill, I've known him for a long time, and he's a man who believes in America and knows more about our Christian history than anybody else, and make a wonderful, wonderful Congress. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and we were talking about what was going on in Germany. They had somebody called, what was he called, Father Christmas or something? He was a fellow all dressed up in green. Why don't you go ahead and pick up where I so rudely interrupted you?
No, it was in England, and they called him Father Christmas because they had outlawed saints.
Okay.
And so, since there were no saints, everybody liked the holiday so much that they basically brought back the old Roman holiday of Saturnalia, and they changed it and called him Father Christmas, it's trying to redeem it a little bit. But when the pilgrims came to America, they didn't celebrate anything. They actually, there was 102 of them, and they bought passage on the Mayflower, which was a sailing ship, and the captain of the Mayflower, the master of the Mayflower, Thomas Jones, wrote in his ship's log on December 25th, 1620, he says, at anchor in Plymouth Harbor, Christmas Day, but not observed by these colonists, being opposed to All Saints' Days, etc. And so the pilgrims did not celebrate Christmas. And that was 102 of them. There were 16,000 Puritans that came over. So we got the pilgrims, then we have the Puritans. The Puritans came over and settled in Massachusetts, and they not only did not celebrate Christmas, they had a 5-shilling fine for anybody caught celebrating Christmas. So they were a real dry group there. And this is what the law said in 1659. It said, whosoever shall be found observing any such day as Christmas or the like, either by forbearing labor, feasting, or any other way upon such an account aforesaid, every such person so offending shall pay a fine of 5 shillings as a fine to the country. So the Puritans not only didn't celebrate Christmas, they had a fine for anybody caught celebrating it. But then the Dutch came over to America, and they did bring with them their St. Nicholas traditions. But the Dutch pronounced St. Nicholas Sant Niklaus. And so if you say Sant Niklaus 3 times fast, Santa Claus, you go, oh, Santa Claus. So that's where our pronunciation of Santa Claus came from, was the Dutch. Anyway, New Amsterdam, which was founded by the Dutch, it didn't last long. It was taken over by the British and turned into New York. That's where New York came from. And the New York was run by the British. They brought over their Father Christmas stories. So it was in New York that the mixing took place between St. Nicholas, or as it was pronounced, Sant Niklaus, and Father Christmas, and into the one person. And Washington Irving, the American author, played a part in that. He wrote Rip Van Winkle and Legend of Sleepy Hollow and a lot of those stories. Washington Irving in 1809 wrote Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York from the Dutch Settlement on, and Dietrich Knickerbocker was a made-up name that Washington Irving used. So he was known for mixing history with fantasy and just sort of an entertaining type of writer. And in this book that he wrote, Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York, he says, now St. Nicholas visits us but once a year, riding in his wagon over the treetops, throwing out presents to his favorites. And Washington Irving describes him and switches it out so he's no longer wearing his Episcopal bishop's robes and the bishop's hat and bishop's staff. Instead, now he's dressed more in a Puritan outfit with a big black belt and big black boots and a broad-rimmed hat and a fur coat. And then the next part of the evolution of the image of St. Nicholas was Clement Moore. He was an Episcopal priest and a Hebrew professor, and in 1823 he wrote A Visit from St. Nicholas, and he's still called St. Nicholas. And I like the part he says, the stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. So now we have St. Nicholas smoking tobacco. Which everybody knows came from the American Indians. You know, Sir Walter Raleigh shipped it back to England. So we got him smoking a pipe. And then it says, a right jolly plump old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. So now he's shrunken in size and he's an elf. And it says his belly shook like a bowl full of jelly, so now he's a little bit overweight. And then the next person that contributed to his evolution was Thomas Nast, N-A-S-T. Thomas Nast was an illustrator for Harper's Weekly magazine, which was popular in the 1800s. And it was during the Civil War that Thomas Nast did a series of pictures, and he was the first one to put a North Pole sign behind a picture of St. Nicholas. And this was a demoralizing moment for the South during the Civil War to now see Nicholas associated with the North. So there was a little political message behind that North Pole sign.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to put off the rest of the story about there really is a Santa Claus until after our next break. And we'll let Bill go ahead. We just won't take any calls at all until you get the entire story of where all of our Christmas traditions came from, the Christmas trees. And it's a wonderful story. And, of course, this and all of Bill's books are available at Radio Liberty. If you'd like to know more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course I want to mention that Abel Federer, our special guest this evening, William Federer, has written America's God and Country. It's an 850-page book going into the Christian history of this country, and has alphabetically arranged the sayings of all of the great leaders, the founding fathers of America, and so much more. This is one of the most amazing books that I have, and I keep it right here beside me so that I can reach up and get a quotation any time I want. And even more than that, there is a CD that goes with that that has twice as much information on it about America's Christian history. In fact, I called Bill this about a week and a half ago to ask him a specific question. He just went to the CD and immediately then emailed me the answer to my question. Awful lot of information. It's just wonderful to have at your fingertips. So if you'd be interested in getting these items, or of course the America, God, and Country, and it's basically it's 1 minute presentations on for every day of the year dealing with our founding fathers. And then of course he's written George Washington Carver, a book on George Washington Carver, a book on St. Patrick, and then this one, There Really Is a Santa Claus. Wonderful, wonderful books. It's a little late for Christmas time, but they'd be good to have in your armamentarium for next Christmas, for birthdays, for special occasions. Wonderful books, and especially I like them all. I think the story of George Washington Carver, however, is running one of my favorites. It's, and of course, the St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus, There Really Is a Santa Claus books. All of them are heartwarming, they're wholesome, and the sort of things that our children should be reading rather than the things that they're being given in school. So if you're interested in knowing anything more about the books, you know our number. Or if you'd like to get that CD, Going Into the Background of America's God and Country, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, our guest is William Federer, and he will be, of course, a candidate for Congress in the St. Louis area. And his emails or his website is federer04.org. And I think that you might well want to go there. Learn a little bit more about this very unusual man who's already run twice for Congress. And what's that, Bill? They say the third time is the charm?
Right, right. Newt Gingrich got in on his third try, so we figured we can do it too.
Well, I'm just hoping and praying, and we will be certainly in prayer for you when that time comes about. Well, for our listeners out there, we're going to be back in just a moment then. As we proceed with the rest of this incredible story, where do our Christmas traditions come from? Well, the book, There Really Is a Santa Claus, will tell you. All right, Bill, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story from there?
The Thomas Nast, N-A-S-T, was the illustrator for Harper's Weekly magazine, and he wrote he did a series of illustrations, and he was the first one to put a North Pole sign behind a picture of Nicholas. And later, the McLaughlin brothers asked Thomas Nast to do a series of pictures of St. Nicholas in color. And so he painted the fur red. So that was the first time that Nicholas's outfit became red. Anyway, the last part of the evolution was the Coca-Cola in the 1930s hired artist Haddon Sunblom to do a series of pictures of St. Nicholas. And, you know, we have national advertising campaigns all the time today. We don't think much of them. But back then, Coca-Cola basically pioneered the idea of a national campaign. And so they spread the image of, you know, Santa Claus all across the country as the warm, fuzzy, blue-eyed, rosy-cheeked, or, you know, huggable grandpa, you know, type. And that's the image that stuck. So he was no longer the elf that Clement Moore had, you know, that the teeny little guy. Now he's a full-grown man again, you know. And so you can see his image has changed, but it all started back in the 3rd century with a real person named Nicholas who went into the ministry, who gave away his wealth to help the poor. He confronted pagan worship, was imprisoned for his faith in Christ, helped write the Nicene Creed that established the doctrine of the Trinity. I mean, this is a very significant religious person, and his generosity with the gift-giving inspired the gift-giving at this holiday. So so it's neat to be able to say that the real person that it all started from was somebody that was worthy of following his example. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, There Really Is a Santa Claus, is the history of St. Nicholas and Christmas holiday tradition. And some of the stories that I put in sort of to highlight how, you know, the version that we have in a, is sort of Americanized. In the Netherlands, they picture, in their history, they have the tradition that St. Nicholas comes every year from Spain, dressed as a bishop, riding a white horse through town, and he has with him his Moorish-costumed helper, Zwarte Piet, Black Peter. And the Moors, of course, were the Muslims who had controlled Spain for 700 years. And the story that the Dutch parents would tell their Dutch children was that St. Nicholas would come on December 6th and give presents to the good kids, and Zwarte Piet would take the bad kids and put them in gunny sacks and take them back to Spain as slaves. And so it was often that if you told a child that St. Nicholas was coming, he'd start crying because he thought it might be his last night on earth. And in Germany, they had a similar story that St. Nicholas came. He was called Weihnachtsmann in Germany. That when St. Nicholas came, he had a little ugly demon helper named Krampus, who was a chain-rattling little guy who would deal with the children who had been naughty, you know, giving them switches and coal and so forth. So, you know, different stories. But still, in continental Europe, Santa Claus or St. Nicholas is still pictured as the saint, as the bishop. And I filled my book full of pictures, and it's neat to see the pictures go from the religious, more or less, icon-type picture that the Greeks had of Nicholas as saint to the European ones where, you know, he's got the big, huge white beard, and he's got the bishop's mitered hat and the big bishop's hook, you know, the shepherd's staff. And then it switches over. There's actually one picture with him on the roof of a house dressed as a bishop listening to hear if the kids have been good or bad. And then, you know, next to that is the picture from Washington Irving of him on the roof of a house, but now he's a little short elf smoking a pipe. And then there's the picture of Thomas Nast where he's pictured as a peddler. He's got all those, you know, sack of toys with all the toys coming out. And then finally the Coca-Cola one. Some of the other parts of the tradition that, you know, I researched and found, some of them have Christian origins and some of them have pagan origins, but what happened was is biblical themes began to be overlaid over the life of Nicholas, over this, you know, sort of mythology that was developed. And the biblical themes were, for example, Christ will return on the day of judgment, and then it was the saints would return with him, and St. Nicholas, being one of those saints, would return with Christ, and then it was that St. Nicholas would sort of come back once a year, sort of a checkup, you know. And then it was Jesus riding a white horse, and then the saints riding white horses. But then in the Netherlands, there's no horses. So, I mean, in Norway, so they rode reindeer. And so that was, and then, you know, there's in heaven, there's the Lamb's Book of Life. If your name's in it, you know, you go to heaven. And then there's the Book of Works that keeps track of all the good things you did and the bad things. And then it was the angels help keep the Book of Works. And then it was the elves help keep the Book of Works. And then, you know, Jesus would come back from the celestial city in the north, and then it was St. Nicholas coming from the same place. And but these were sort of biblical themes that got overlaid. And, you know, in the Middle Ages, the Bible was in Latin, and the people spoke German and French and Italian and English, and so they didn't really speak the common language. And so there was room for, you know, some of these extra type of legends and traditions to sort of develop. Anyway, some of the, I guess, more pagan traditions that came in was in Norway and Denmark. They had this superstition of a Nisse, N-I-S-S-E, which was a gnome-like little creature, an elf, a sprite. It was basically a poltergeist, a little mischievous spirit that they would leave a bowl of porridge out on Christmas Eve to appease the spirit so it wouldn't cause mischief. So that's where I guess where leaving the glass of milk out for Santa came from. And that, you know, is also sort of the origins of the trick-or-treat in the, you know, the Druids had in Ireland. You know, you leave the treat out so you don't get tricked. So that part was pagan. The mistletoe was more or less of a Druid thing that, you know, you'd kiss under it and it's supposed to bring fertility. The Yule log, the Druids had where you would have luck if you could burn a log throughout the entire winter solstice. And and then save the ashes and then sprinkle them on your field. And if you could save a piece of the log till the next year, that was supposed to bring luck. And so the Yule log wasn't a Christian thing. And then the wassailing. Here we go, a wassailing among the... Well, wassailing was they'd get an ale or a punch, and they'd go out and sprinkle it on their fields and their beehives and on their, you know, plants to supposedly bring, you know, luck for the next year. So that was, you know, more or less of a pagan origin. It's fascinating to go back. One of the things that I did was research, like, for example, the 12 days of Christmas. And, you know, I always thought when I was a kid it was the 12 days leading up to Christmas. Well, no. What happened was in the 6th century, they had an argument in Europe over which day was holier. Was it December 25th in Western Europe, Christmas, or was it January 6th in Eastern Europe, Epiphany, where the wise men visited Jesus and Jesus was presented in the temple as a baby? Well, they couldn't decide, and so they decided to make all 12 days from December 25th to January 6th the 12 days of Christmas. And they called them holy days, and the word holy day ended up coming down pronounced as holiday, which I think is sort of humorous because the ACLU wants to make sure we don't have a Christmas celebration, so they say, well, let's just have a winter holiday. Well, the word holiday means holy day, and what day was holy other than Christmas? You know, another is the 12 Days of Christmas song, that the earliest references that I've seen is the 1500s in England is where the song originated from, and early on there were associated with it sort of catechism song, sort of like a Sunday school song for kids. And there were meanings ascribed to the turtle doves and so forth. So it wasn't just a nonsensical poem. It sort of had a little meaning. And I'm not saying this is absolutely the meanings, but this is one of the ones that I found, at least early on, these meanings were ascribed to the song. My true love was God himself. A partridge was Jesus. Because a partridge would feign injury to distract a predator from the nest. It would lie on the ground and sort of flap and to draw a cat away so it wouldn't kill the little baby. So that was the partridge was Jesus. The pear tree was the cross where Christ died, or the tree of Adam and Eve's fall. The two turtle doves were the Old and New Testament. The three French hens were faith, hope, and love. The four calling birds were the four Gospels. The five golden rings were the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch. The six geese laying were the 6 days of creation. The seven swans of swimming were the seven gifts of the Spirit. The eight maids of milking were the eight Beatitudes. Nine ladies dancing were the nine fruits of the Spirit. 10 lords a-leaping was the Ten Commandments. 11 pipers piping were the 11 faithful apostles. And 12 drummers drumming were the 12 points of the Apostles' Creed. So it's sort of like a Sunday school song where you teach the little kids something to help them remember. The word holly came from the word holy, and they would decorate it, their homes and their churches, on the holy days with it. The poinsettia, that was a recent one. In Mexico, they had the flower of the holy night, where their story is that a Mexican little boy was kneeling and praying on Christmas Eve, and the flower sprung up. And our ambassador to Mexico, under Franklin Pierce, who was the 14th president, the ambassador's name was Joel R. Poinsett. And he saw the flower the holy night and liked it and brought it back to South Carolina and planted it. It became popular, so it got the name poinsettia after the ambassador Joel R. Poinsett. And in the book, I put lots of neat Christmas things. Handel's Messiah was written by George Friedrich Handel in only 21 days, incredibly. And at the premiere opening of it, it was performed for King George II, who was before King George III. This was King George II. And during the Hallelujah chorus, King George II stood to his feet, and he was so moved. And so that started the story of people standing for the Hallelujah chorus. Another was the Hark the Herald Angels Sing, was written by Charles Wesley. And his brother John Wesley founded Methodism. And this song, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, became popular in about 1753, and that was when George Washington was 21 years old. So if you can imagine, George Washington is 21, and they just came out with this brand new Christmas hymn, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas was written by the son of a Jewish rabbi. His name was Irving Berlin, and he immigrated from Russia in 1888, and fought in World War One. He wrote God Bless America and donated the royalties to the Boy Scouts. And he wrote White Christmas. I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas by Irving Berlin. Another one I thought was interesting was a Danish Christmas carol called Barn Jesus. And barn was the Danish word for child. And it was written by Hans Christian Andersen. Now, we know him because he wrote Ugly Duckling and The Emperor's New Clothes and so forth. But Hans Christian Andersen wrote Denmark's most favorite Christmas carol. And here's a couple of the words, you know, translated. Child Jesus came to earth this day to save us sinners dying, and cradled in the straw and hay the Holy One is lying. The star shines down the child to greet, the lowly men kiss his feet. Hallelujah, hallelujah, child Jesus. Take courage, soul so weak and worn, thy sorrows have departed. A child in David's town is born to heal the brokenhearted. Then let us haste this child to find, and children be in heart and mind. Hallelujah, hallelujah, child Jesus. And that was written by the same guy that wrote The Ugly Duckling and The Emperor's New Clothes, Hans Christian Andersen.
Now, what about the Christmas tree? Where did the Christmas tree come in?
Now, that's a neat thing. There's actually two ingredients. There's the light and the tree. The lights go back to the earliest references at lights at that time of the year was Hanukkah. It was the Jewish festival of lights or feast of dedication. And in the back of my book, I put a little bit on the Festival of Lights and several of the presidential addresses on Hanukkah, and President Bush was the first one to have the Hanukkah lighting in the White House. But in 165 B.C., the Syrians conquered Israel, and the Syrian king was Antiochus Epiphanes, and he was particularly pagan, so much so that he desecrated the temple in Jerusalem by sacrificing a pig. And he made all the Levite priests sacrifice pigs, which was the most abhorrent thing for them. And he would kill babies who the mothers had circumcised. And one story that the mother had circumcised her baby against the, you know, Antiochus's orders, and so they killed the baby and hung it around her neck and marched her through town, you know, to scare people. And just a horrible guy. He was, you know, sort of like a Saddam Hussein, I guess. And anyway. He would go up into the mountains and force the little towns to sacrifice pigs because the Levites would live in all these different towns. And one particular town, the Levite family known as the Maccabees, they, instead of killing the pigs, turned around and attacked the soldiers and killed them and then ran off into the mountains and started a guerrilla movement, and it grew and grew and grew, and they took back town after town and city after city. Finally, they took back Jerusalem, and they drove the pagans, the Syrians out, and cleansed the temple and pulled out the old golden menorah candlestick and looked around for some oil to light it with, and they only found enough oil for one day. And it took a whole entire week to make this special oil. Well, they poured the little bottle of oil into the oil lamp and lit it, and it burned one day, 2 day, 3 day, 4 day, 5 day, 6 day. It burned entire 8 days, and so that was the miracle of the Festival of Lights or Feast of Dedication, you know, dedicating the temple, which today is called Hanukkah. And I thought it was interesting. In John chapter 20, it says, "And Jesus was in Jerusalem for the Feast of Dedication, and he was walking among Solomon's porch." And I thought, well, here's Jesus is in Jerusalem for Hanukkah, for the Feast of Dedication. And so, you know, Christians can celebrate Hanukkah too. It's not one of those, you know, holidays that's just peculiar to the Jews. It's something that, you know, if Jesus celebrated, like, we can too. And it's a wonderful historic time. But that's basically where the lights came from at Christmas time. And then the tree had the earliest references I could find to a evergreen tree was Tertullian, who was an early church father in the 200s, and he wrote, "You are the light of the world, a tree evergreen, if you have renounced the heathen temples." And, you know, because back then, you know, people would sacrifice at the heathen temples. Well, and then it, don't read much of it until the year 400. There were the pagan tribes that had overrun the Roman Empire. The Visigoths and Ostrogoths and Angles and Saxons and basically the Germans and the Franks. And in Germany, at Geismar, they had this pagan god of Thor, who they thought lived in a big oak tree, and they would sacrifice humans to it, and they were about to sacrifice Little Prince Alsuf to the Blood Oak there at Geismar, and Boniface, who was a bold missionary, walks into the midst and breaks up the ceremony and takes an axe and begins to chop down the tree. And they're about to attack him, and somebody yells, "Wait a second, if Thor is really a god, let him protect his own tree." And they say, "Well, yeah, yeah, let him do it." And so they stand back, and there's nobody protecting him. So he chops that tree down, and Boniface, this is what he said, "This is the word, and this is the counsel. Not a drop of blood shall fall tonight, for this is the birth night of Christ, Son of the All-Father, Savior of the world." And he points at a little fir tree. He says, "This little tree, a young child of the forest, shall be a home tree tonight. It is a wood of peace, for your homes are built of fir. It is the sign of endless life, for its branches are evergreen. See how it points toward heaven. Let this be called the tree of the Christ child. Gather about it, not in the wild woods, but in your homes. There it will shelter no deeds of blood, but loving gifts of light and kindness." And so that was in 400 A.D. And then it wasn't really until 1520 where Martin Luther, the story is he was walking home one night, looked up in the sky and saw the beautiful stars, and came home, put a tree up, and then put little candles in the branches and told his children, "This is like the sky above Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth." And so it was the lights came from the Hanukkah and the tree came from all those different places, but it was Martin Luther that brought the two of them together and put the lights on the tree. And it's a neat little tradition there as well. But also in the book, I put all the things that happened. Oh, one other thing I thought was interesting was Xmas. You know how you see the X and then the hyphen and then M-A-S, and I always thought, well, that's terrible, they're crossing out Jesus. Well, come to find out doing research that X is the Greek letter for Christ. It's called Christos. And in the Middle Ages, in 1390, for example, they had the cross Christ, and then later called it was the Christ cross, Christ cross, and they would have the children learn the alphabet. And it was called the Christ cross row, because they would have the cross of Christ, and the children would then would say an invocation, "May Christ cross give me speed, give me success," and then they would recite the alphabet. And that crisscross, that Christ cross, ended up coming down to us as the form of a written oath. In other words, in a court, you put your hand on your Bible and you say, "So help me God." Well, if it's a written oath, you would sign at the Christ cross, swearing before God that what you're about to sign is true. You know, or it's, and it's binding. So if you go to the bank and open up an account and you sign it on the X, that X, that crisscross, means the cross of Christ, that you're taking an oath before God. That's the origin of that anyway. And then the AD, BC, you know, BC before Christ, and AD is Anno Domini, which means in the year of the Lord's reign. You know, like instead of saying, well, in the 21st year of, you know, the reign of King so-and-so, it was the 2003rd year of the reign of King Jesus. That was where that came from. And it's interesting that the entire world is now dated not by the Chinese calendar, not by the Muslim calendar, you know, not by the French Revolution where they made 1793 the new year one, you know, but the entire world is dated back to the date of Christ's birth. And it's sort of humorous that some of the academics don't want to say before Christ and AD Anno Domini, so they call it BCE, before Common Era, and the ACE, after Common Era, whatever. But what is the date that they use? They use the date of Christ's birth. So even they can't get away from it, even though they change up the numbers. You know, the BC to from being before Christ to being before Common Era. I love a quote that I found from Clarence Mannion, who was the dean of the Notre Dame Law School in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and Clarence Mannion wrote this. He said, "The long march of measured time suddenly stopped, and then it did an about-face and marched in the other direction, and to a different drum straight through the ensuing centuries of Christ and Christendom. B.C., before Christ, and A.D., Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, mark each one of the only reliable milestones along the path of world history. The end of the first time chain and the beginning of the second came together on the night that Christ was born in Bethlehem. The first Christmas day thus stands as the great divide for the timing and recording of all people, things, and events that have lived or taken place upon this earth. It is the one place where an inquiring mind can go in either direction without stopping. The one place in the long, long trail of time where the magnetic needle of history stands vertical and points up. Well, what a nice description of how the night of Christ's birth.
And you know, it really is amazing that for somebody who never left the Holy Land, never led an army, never wrote a book, and yet, of course, more books have been written about him than about any other person who ever lived. Because, of course, as you say, his birth marked the point that where all history begins and where all dating begins. And, of course, in that one single life came a message that would change the world forever.
And there are more Bibles. The Bible is the all-time world's best-selling book. And, but anyway, in the back of the book, I put things that happen on Christmas throughout history. For example, 800 A.D. on Christmas Day, Charlemagne, King of France, was knighted Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Leo III on Christmas Day. You know, little things like that. Clovis in 496 on Christmas Day. Clovis, the King of France, along with 3,000 of his warriors, converted to Christianity and were baptized in Reims, France. And then in 1492, on Christmas Eve, Christopher Columbus's ship, the Santa Maria, ran aground on the island of Haiti. And Columbus leaves the sailors there, 40 of them, and he names the settlement La Navidad, which means the Nativity, you know, like Feliz Navidad. And then a famous one is Christmas Day evening, 1776. George Washington was trapped there along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania. And at midnight on Christmas Day evening, he marches across the, they get the ships, boats, they go across the Delaware River, and in complete silence, they march all night long through a blizzard, and the next morning attack the German Hessian troops that were stationed at Trenton, and captured 1,000 of them. And that battle began the turning point in the Revolutionary War, where we finally eventually won. So a critical battle. The next Christmas was 1777, and that was when our troops were at Valley Forge. And this is what George Washington recorded. He said, "To see men without clothes to cover their nakedness, without blankets to lay on, without shoes by which their marches might be traced by the blood from their feet, and at Christmas taking up their quarters within a day's march of the enemy, is a mark of patience and obedience which, in my opinion, can scarce be paralleled." So even you know, on Christmas, we've had happy Christmases and sad Christmases, and then 1777 also.
Bill, we're out of time. It's been a fascinating, fascinating hour, but I really want to thank you so much for being with us here as we approach the holidays, and I hope what the message you've given will inspire many of the people who listen to it this evening. They'll want to get the book. Yes, there really is a Santa Claus, but even more than that, to understand the traditions which we hold to be so important at this time of year, traditions that the world may have forgotten, but those of us who believe in Jesus Christ will honor as long as we live. Thank you so very much for being with us, and have a wonderful and merry Christmas season.
Dan, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it so much. You're tremendous, and I just encourage all the listeners, to, if they can, to order that book, contact Radio Liberty and get the book. There really is a Santa Claus. And Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Good night. God bless you. And that's about all I can say. Merry Christmas to all. To all a good night. And till Monday, we'll be back with you once again. Good night. May the Lord be with you. Well, good evening once again. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, they're the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Chris Milligan, and Chris is a book publisher. He's a patriot. He's spent a lot of time researching what's going on today. He publishes, Fleshing Out of Skull and Bones, and The American Establishment by Professor Sutton, and Colonel Marvin's book, Expendable Elite, a book by Daniel Hupsiger, Barry and the Boys Going into the CIA and Drugs. And, of course, Barry Seal was the most notorious drug smuggler of modern times, smuggled almost $1 billion worth of drugs. He was part of the CIA apparatus, and, of course, he eventually paid the price that so many people do who become involved with the Murder Incorporated of the United States, and he himself was assassinated after being forced to be at a certain point every day by legal order. He'd been protected by our government for many years, and yet in the end, of course, he was betrayed, as so often happens. Well, this evening, though, I thought maybe we'd talk about Professor Sutton. Actually, Anthony Sutton was never able to get a doctorate, not that he wasn't good enough for it, but because he told the truth. He was at the Hoover Institute, and they would not give him a doctorate because, very specifically, because of his research. His line of research was going into who financed communism, and of course he found out that it was financed in large part, the Russian dictatorship was financed by the American Federal Reserve, the Rockefellers, the Harrimans, major American corporations, and of course with their English counterparts, financed the Russian Revolution. And if you've read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, we give many other references that he didn't have, but Professor Sutton did a magnificent job of going into the background of how through the years, from 1918 on, in three books, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, a series of volumes, three volumes, pointed out how the United States provided the money and the technology and the ability of Russia to survive. Without help from the West, Russia never would have survived. But you see, we had to have an enemy, and communism was the finest enemy that could be bought with the money from our great corporations and our banks, yes, and even loans from the American Federal Reserve System. But when you tell the truth, that isn't very popular, at least with the people who lead academia, specifically at the Hoover Institute. So they have a lot of good-hearted researchers there, some very, very excellent people. But they don't get into subjects like this, maybe because they don't believe in it, or maybe because they want to stay at the Hoover Institute. But I'll never forget when Professor Sutton, well, let's talk to Chris, and maybe we can share some of the memories we have of Professor Sutton, because I knew him. He lived here in Santa Cruz for a time. I knew him when, of course, he was doing his research, and then some difficult times in his life, and then when he went over to Africa, and we have some wonderful stories to tell about that. And I'm sure that Chris has many wonderful stories to tell about this very remarkable man who documented for history's sake the fact that communism, Russian communism, Russian brutal communism was largely financed from the United States, that Adolf Hitler and the ruthless Nazis were funded by the United States. And, of course, even during the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese were funded by the United States. How else could this small nation, the size of the state of Mississippi, stand against the mightiest nation in the world for a period of 10 years? You saw what we did in Iraq. But we were just as powerful during the Vietnam. The only reason the war lasted as long is because we continued to finance the North Vietnamese so we could have a war, because the war had nothing to do with fighting communism. We financed it. The Russians all during that period of time. And we're, of course, opening up our doors to a communist China. No, the war in Vietnam was fought not to defeat communism, but to change America forever, as we adopted point after point after point of the Communist Manifesto, and America changed forever during that era. Chris, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan, my pleasure.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about how you happened to meet Professor Sutton and your view of him and the work that he did?
Well, I happened to meet Professor Sutton. I'd been, actually it was through my father. I mean, I didn't meet him through my father, but my father told me some things. My father was in the CIA. He was branch chief head of all of East Asia. And he had told me, he had mentioned to me that the Vietnam War, he said it was about drugs. There was these secret societies behind it. And then he said, and communism was all a sham. These same secret societies were behind it. And I didn't understand it. He told me that in the late 60s. I didn't think about it too much. I did a little bit of, was doing some research into the Kennedy assassination and was reading a magazine article about it. And they mentioned in there, were mentioning all the different conspiracy theories around the Kennedy assassination, and they happened to mention that there were some people that said that there was secret society involvement, and that brought back the conversation my dad had had, and I kept on researching and looking into secret societies, and I heard about this, this society called the Order of Skull and Bones, and I couldn't really find much information. I finally found somebody told me about Professor Sutton's book, America's Secret Establishment, The Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, in about 1988 when Bush was running, George H.W. Bush was running for president. And I found that book, and it helped me understand some things that my father had told me. And I kept on looking into it, and then I started doing some writing about it, and I, the internet came along, and I put up an article I had written about the Skull and Bones up on the internet, and then one day Professor Sutton sent me an email, and we corresponded, and I was very delighted to be in contact with the gentleman, because I tried to write him before through his through some people out of Montana, people that were publishing his book in paperback, and nobody ever answered. And then all of a, you know, several years later, he sent me an email, and I corresponded with him and wanted to meet with him. And Professor Sutton was very much of a recluse. He had when he brought out his books, he'd gotten some interesting phone calls, and then also he would get pigeonholed into being a right-wing John Bircher, and he didn't really, he didn't feel that he was a right-wing John Bircher. He was more of a, I considered himself a libertarian. And so he had pulled back, and he hadn't had a lot of contact with people. And it took me a couple years of contact with him to get him to meet with me. And we met a couple times, and then we kept on corresponding, and I found out that the when he first had printed his book, America's Secret Establishment, he'd actually printed in some booklets, and he really was having a hard time getting them printed here and was getting them printed in Australia. And he had a newsletter, and some people in Montana, Don, I can't think of his last name, had been members of his newsletter, and they couldn't believe that nobody would print his book here, publish his book here, and so they were just a mom-and-pop print shop in Montana, and they started printing it, putting it together for him in about 1986, and I had heard that they were going out of business and they weren't going to be printing it anymore. and I felt that it was something that needed to stay in print, and also had it never been widely distributed, hadn't been, you know, distributed by into like Borders and Barnes and Noble. I'd gone into lots of bookstores and never really seen it in, on the shelves, and it had never been in hardback, and I thought it'd be a good idea to put it in hardback and try and get it distributed to all the bookstores. And Professor Sutton hadn't really been doing a lot of talking about Skull and Bones. He'd mostly gone back to his first love, which was he was basically a technology researcher, and he was producing a newsletter called Future Technology Intelligence Review, and had done that for the last 10 years. And hadn't really been talking about Skull and Bones, but we had gotten back ready to contacted some radio people, and he was ready to go back on the radio and talk about Skull and Bones and whatnot. We're going to have his book, you know, officially come out in September. And in the book business, you get a book printed before it comes out so that you can send out copies to reviewers and different things. And we got his book back in May, and 3 weeks after we got it, he passed away under some interesting circumstances. As far as the coroner told us, it was... he said there was, you know, no, it was natural causes, but he passed away on an anniversary date that was special to Skull and Bones, which I found interesting.
Well, you know, I've had an opportunity to meet him several times when he lived here in Santa Cruz. And then when I was over, I practiced medicine in Africa. I taught at a major university there in the mid-1970s. And I was able to get in contact with the South African counterpart of the CIA. It was known as BOSS, Bureau of State Security. And I had a good friend who was a high official in BOSS. He was a station chief. And he told me that Professor Sutton was going to come over to South Africa and talk to the members of their Bureau of State Security, and then to the head of their Bureau of State Security, and then meet with the Premier of South Africa and explain to them about the secret societies that rule the world. So I thought that was really very interesting. I was getting ready to return home myself about that time when I got a call from the station chief at BOSS, and he said, "Have you seen Professor Sutton?" And I said, "Well, no, I haven't." He said, "Well, it's the strangest thing. He disappeared." And I said, "He did what?" He said, "He disappeared. He was supposed to meet with the head of a Bureau of State Security yesterday. I went to a hotel to pick him up. He wasn't there. He had signed out of the hotel. Left no message with me. Left no message with anybody. He's just disappeared." And I said, "Well, gee, I thought maybe he'd come down to visit you because he'd talked about that since he'd known you when you were here in South Africa." No, I said, "He didn't come to visit me at all." Well, anyway, the bureau chief asked if I would check when I went home, because I was going home within the next 3 or 4 days, traveling back to the United States, which I did. And when I got to Santa Cruz, I called Professor Sutton, and he said, "I'll tell you what." He said, I'll tell you what happened. Let's meet at the Seascape Golf Course in Aptos, which place we went. And he told me some amazing, amazing stories. He said, "You know, I was in my hotel room in South Africa, there at the major hotel, I forgot the Ritz Hotel or one of the others, and there came a knock at the door, and a gentleman standing there, he said, I won't tell you who he was, but he was from an American intelligence unit like the CIA or the FBI or the military intelligence or naval intelligence, and he said, 'Professor Sutton, you are not to meet with the head of the Bureau of State Security tomorrow. Your life is in danger. Here is a ticket. You will leave immediately for the United States and not come back here again.'" He said, "I didn't argue with him. I left." And he said, "This is not the first time things like this have happened." He said, "When I was at Hoover Institute and I had completed my first volume of Western technology and Soviet economic development, pointing out the fact that the United States had financed the Soviet Union from its inception, and very powerful people here had done that. I was called into the office of the head of the Hoover Institute and instructed that I would not proceed with this line of research anymore. And I told him, I said, well, this is academic freedom. I'm here. I have a contract for 3 years, and I want to continue this line of work. And the head of the Hoover Institute said, well, you will not continue this line of work. And Sutton said, but I have a contract. And the man said, yes, but you don't have a copy of the contract. And here's how much you owe on your house. You have a daughter who is in college. Here's how much money you have in the bank. And I would like to suggest that you consider what will happen when you find yourself out of work tomorrow. How will you provide for your family, your home, your daughter in college? I suggest you consider very strongly my suggestion that you change your line of work. And so Professor Sutton said, well, he went home and he was torn, but he was in a situation there was absolutely nothing he could do. When you're in academics, you know, you have to have a job, you have to support yourself. He didn't have any money. He wanted to continue uncovering the secrets about how American industry, Western governments, and our government specifically had funded and helped communism from its inception. And he was just about ready to go back to Hoover Institute and tell the man who was in charge that he was willing to give in when a knock came at the door. And there were two men there, and one of them, and they were wearing overcoats. I remember he's telling me that, and one of them saying, Professor Sutton, I understand that you're having problems at the Hoover Institute, and they don't want you to continue your line of research. And Professor Sutton said, I agreed with him. And whereupon he reached into his pocket and said, I understand you don't have a copy of your contract. Here's a copy of your contract. You'll be able to continue your line of research. And there it was. It was a copy of the contract, which he didn't have. And, of course, with that, they couldn't fire him, and he was able to stay on there for several more years. In fact, what happened at the Hoover Institute in 1972, in the middle of the Vietnam War, he went before the Republican National Committee and gave a talk about how the United States was funding North Vietnam by lending money to Russia, and Russia was providing the weapons with our money to keep the North Vietnamese going. And, of course, when he returned to the Hoover Institute, somebody had removed his name from the door, removed his number from the telephone book. All the furniture was gone from the office, and it wasn't too long after that he was forced to leave Hoover Institute. But that is what's known as academic freedom at the conservative Hoover Institute in Palo Alto. At least this was the story that Professor Sutton told me. Did he ever tell you anything similar?
Yes. And then he had actually went ahead and printed the third volume on his own money. They had asked him not to look into the military side of some of this technical assistance, and he wasn't going to print that with the stuff with the Hoover Institute. But then he went ahead and contacted Arlington House and went ahead and published it outside of them, kind of forced them to print it. And then he had also mentioned that it had been he had gotten encouragement from some FBI people, and he always told me, he says, you know, not all spooks are bad spooks.
Well, I think that most people don't understand, really, that we financed communism, we financed Adolf Hitler, and we've always created the best enemies money can buy. In fact, Professor Sutton even wrote a book by that title, The Best Enemies mm-hmm. Money Can Buy. And then in 1980, I paid his way down to Greenville, South Carolina, and there at the Bob Jones University, we filmed an interview, and we have that interview still. We offer that. It's called The Best Enemies Money Can Buy, where we talk about many of the things we've just discussed. And I think that's probably the only video available of Professor Sutton. Do you know of any others where he did a filmed interview?
Yes, he had done a filmed interview with a gentleman from Holland, who was putting together a video on Skull and Bones, and also on the subject of CIA drugs. There was another researcher independently of myself who had also come to some of the same conclusions, and was found that the two subjects intersected. And he came over and did a very nice interview with Professor Sutton, also interviewed Anton Chaykin and Webster Tarpley Griffin and a couple other people. And they spent about $100,000 Dutch money putting together a very nice documentary on Skull and Bones, about 2 hours.
Are they available now?
No, it got all the way, just to show you the reach of these people. It doesn't just happen in the United States. But it got all the way to be listed in a TV guide and was going to run on this Thursday night, and then it got pulled. And it finally ran about 2 years later, about 1999 or so, in January on a Friday at 5 o'clock, about 40 minutes of 80 minutes ran, and so there are some other ones out there. They aren't. It isn't available. We're talking with the people and trying to get the footage and put it together in a film about Skull and Bones, and it looks like we might be able to do that, but I don't think it'll be available till next winter at some time. So right now, no, the only videotaped interview, there is one other one that I've been told is out there. I haven't seen it. It was done by the Church Universal Triumphant did a video interview with him also, that I've been told by some people is available at some public library.
Is that Elizabeth Clare Prophet or what?
Yes.
Well, it's a little crazy religiously, but you know, they did put out some good information. Well, Professor Quigley really had done an amazing job getting the background of this secret organization, and this truly is a secret organization. These people swear horrible blood oaths, and of course, everything is secret. Nobody's really ever come forward and talked about it. Alexandra Robbins wrote a book called The Secrets of the Tomb, where supposedly several members of the Skull and Bones told her what really went on inside. But I suspect very strongly, and after interviewing Alexandra, my gut feeling is that they were feeding her disinformation and misinformation, because, of course, the only person we know who's ever really seen one of the ceremonies gave an entirely different description of what it was, and this was actually Alexandra describes this woman hiding in a hayloft when there was a Skull and Bones wedding going on, and this was truly a pagan, totally pagan proceeding.
Oh, well, yes, and anytime you have a secret society, and you know, we can divorce all the politics and all the stuff from it and just look at it from a sociological standpoint or an anthropological standpoint, and secret societies operate pretty much the same all over the world, whether you know you're involved in an African secret society, a Chinese secret society, a Western secret society. You have you know, it's like an onion or a pyramid. You have a big base, a large outer covering, and these are called porch brethren in Masonic circles. And then you have a next level of administrative control, and then you have a core group. And the thing that, like in Skull and Bones that you find there, the core group, they're all blood related. And basically what you have in these secret societies at the core is a multi-generational cult of people that are all related. In Skull and Bones, the main person that they all seem to be related to is the Cabot. And then they seem to do things that are, seem to be very important on days that are important to the Cabots. And then it's very interesting if you want to study the opium smuggling in the early 1800s. One of the best places to find about American opium smuggling is in a book about the Cabot genealogy.
Well, now, what was the relationship to the Russells? Because it was Russell who created the Skull and Bones, and their family was involved with this drug smuggling.
Right. Well, they're related to the Cabots, and the Russells are related to the Cabots. The streets are related to the Russells, who built a thing around Skull and Bones, and then Benjamin Silliman, he's related to the Russells, who again are all related to the Cabots. And Silliman was a member of Skull and Bones who invented the first petrochemicals. Skull and Bones has been involved with the gasoline business. And one thing that Professor Sutton worked on for a long time was different energy sources. And he would talk about how, you know, there was lots of different energy models that we could be using. But, you know, we're hooked up to the oil store, and these secret societies have us all, you know, hooked up to the oil store, and it's like Mr. Diesel. When Mr. Diesel was having his engine was running off of a peanut oil, but pretty soon Mr. Diesel died, and they took the diesel engine and refitted it so it ran on a petrochemical. But see, it could be running on vegetable oil, and a lot of the plastics and all the petrochemical. I mean, it's absolutely insane. You know, we cut down our forest and make newspaper. And when they started in the 1920s, our Department of Agriculture was starting to say, hey, we're cutting down too many trees, and, you know, we can make paper out of other things. We can make paper out of, like, hemp and whatnot. And one thing that I've come to find out is, like, the prohibition against marijuana really has nothing to do with our health, has nothing to do with our children. It has to do with these secret societies. Two things. It has with them keeping a black market so that they can sell not only marijuana but heroin and cocaine in a black market, but it also has to do with keeping the petrochemical industry just as part of the oil. And instead of having, because like marijuana you can make, or hemp you can make paper out of it, that's very good paper that you don't have to use a bunch of chemicals on to bleach and other things, and all kinds of plastics and whatnot that you can make out of hemp and other vegetable material. And they use, they're very insidious in that they, you know, they use the Hegelian dialectic, the synthesis.
They create a problem, and then, of course, they set out to solve it.
But right,
they have to have the problem before they can solve it. And I think the important thing about Skull and Bones is that these are the people who rule the United States. They control banking in large part through many of the major banking concerns, Brown Brothers, Harriman, and others, and tie into the Morgans and all the international financiers. And then, of course, they have their people in key positions in the academic spheres. They have their people in key positions in industry and the great tax-exempt foundations. But, of course, most important, they have their people planted within the CIA. In fact, there's even a division of the CIA that's referred to as the Bones part of the CIA, because all of these people, Skull and Bones, people like William Buckley, oh, that great conservative. Everybody knows he's conservative. He publishes the National Review, and William Buckley was Skull and Bones. And so many of the key people working within the so-called conservative movement and within the liberal movement all come from Skull and Bones, so they control both sides. But the people, of course, who become the United States senators, like John Kerry, Prescott Bush, and the people who become presidents of the United States and chief of the CIA, like George Herbert Walker Bush, we really have to be concerned, because these people have sworn oaths that certainly outrank their oaths to the United States. They've sworn oaths to a different force, to a different organization, which is a secret society, and I don't think anybody who's sworn an oath to a secret society should ever serve in a major position in government. Do you?
No, and like Professor Sutton always said, you know, he says these people bring about wars that they plan to lose, and wars that you know, they foment war with their managed conflict.
Yeah, well, I think we're seeing that exactly at the present time. We'll be back here in just a moment or two. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls here at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest is Chris Mulligan. We're talking about the Skull and Bones Society and other work that Professor Sutton had done to expose the dark forces that work behind the scenes at every level of our government today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. And if you believe that there really are forces out there that are unknown, that somebody has to point out what's going on, to circulate and give people the opportunity to buy books on Skull and Bones. And we could just mention Alexandra Robbins' book, The Secrets of the Tomb, two books that our guest this evening, Chris Milligan, has published. One is Fleshing Out of Skull and Bones. The other is the American Establishment, which he's put out in a beautiful hardbound edition. This is Professor Sutton's book, going to the background of this secret society. And then, of course, we carry, syllabuses with all the lists of the names of all of the members of Skull and Bones from their own records. We have a four-tape set on Skull and Bones. All of this information is available about this most important secret society, especially when our current president is a member of this secret society, which certainly is anti-Christian in everything it represents. And I would feel so much better if the president would simply renounce his membership instead of inviting the members of Skull and Bones to the White House for celebrations and appointing so many of the members of Skull and Bones to key positions within his administration. But we find the people in Skull and Bones like Secretary of War Stimson, intimately involved with the creation of the Second World War. He was Secretary of War and was instrumental. He was one of the people who was instrumental in getting America into World War II. And then, of course, a man that Secretary of War Stimson worked very closely with, a man named McGeorge Bundy. And they even wrote a book together. But McGeorge Bundy was the National Security Advisor to both President Johnson and President Kennedy, and was instrumental in getting us involved in the Vietnam War. And, of course, people don't know that. McGeorge Bundy, when he left his position, went to work as the president of the Ford Foundation. And, of course, the Secretary of State at that time was a man named Dean Rusk. He went to work as the president of the, or I should say returned to work, as president of the Rockefeller Foundation. And they were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and at least McGeorge Bundy and Stimson were both members of the Council on Foreign Relations, as, of course, are most people in key positions in government, and even the people who surround President Bush today, people like Henry Kissinger, people like Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, all come from the Council on Foreign Relations, the American extension of another secret society. And, of course, that other secret society is described by Professor Quigley in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, a book that was really so significant that no sooner was it published back in 1966 than somebody came in and purchased Macmillan Company that had published the book and destroyed the place of the first half of Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And if that story sounds incredible to you, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that exact story, and you'll find it fascinating as you hear Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, talking about how somebody purchased his publisher house, destroyed the plates to the first half of the book, and then lied to him for years, and everything was done to suppress his book and keep it from ever being reprinted. The only reason it ever was reprinted is somebody pirated the book and put it out and distributed copies, and eventually Professor Quigley got the copyright back because his publisher would not republish their own book, even though there were thousands and thousands of requests for it, and there was a tremendous profit to be made, but they wouldn't republish it. So he, of course, gave the right to publish it to the pirate, and that's why the book is available today. So there is information that's suppressed. Well, let's get back to our special guest this evening, Chris Milligan. And, of course, we've been talking about Skull and Bones and how these people involved with the drug trade and the CIA, involved with the CIA, which is involved with the drug trade. We have over 2 million Americans in prison today. Almost, not quite, but almost 1% of our population. And so many of the people are there because of drugs. Of course, many of them have worked for the CIA and the DEA and the FBI, and they've tried to expose our government's involvement in the drug trade. And, of course, they have been sent to prison. This is the last thing they can allow is for the American people to know what's going on. If you go to, of course, the website from the Wilderness, Michael Rupert's website, he even had, at least until recently, a link to the CIA GAO report admitting that the CIA was involved in drugs. But the average American was never allowed to know that. So why don't you pick up the story from there, Chris? What is your thought on the Skull and Bones, having studied this? What do you think about the secret society, and should the American people be concerned that there is a secret society with people planted at every level of our government whose loyalty is not to our country, but to the goals and objectives of Skull and Bones?
Most assuredly, we should be concerned, because for one thing is they lie, you know, they're in very high levels. I mean, you have the president, his father, his grandfather. He appointed the head of the SEC is a member of Skull and Bones, helped covering. You know, we don't hear much about Enron anymore. I mean, you live there in California. You pay some high utility bills. And, you know, a lot of that had to do with Enron, and it's been proven that they were, you know, they were lying to the California people, trying to, you know, get a big problem, to create a crisis.
They did create the crisis. The whole energy, electricity crisis, deregulation crisis was created to drive the prices up so we wouldn't use so much electricity.
Right, and to just, you know, and to create chaos in the government there. One thing that these people are trying to do is, and this goes back to the late 1700s, these people do not enjoy a republic, the republican form of government, government based on a republic where you're based upon individual freedoms and rights and liberties. They want us to be more in a fascist state, more of a statist state, you know. And one reason that, you know, I keep doing this is to get the information out there so that people that are in, you know, the intelligence services and whatnot, we can help take away the hoodwink so they can understand who it is that they're actually working for. Because we live in this country today, this secret society, you know, let's say that we did live in a monarchy where you had, you know, and you wanted to get your guy on to be king. Well, if you're a secret society, you know, you'd have to come together with a plan, and then you'd have to finance the plan, and then you'd have to pull the plan off to put your guy into the seat so that then he could pass out, you know, all the goodies. Well, basically what the secret societies have done, with Skull and Bones being the main one that we can discover and talk about there, they have created the national security state, and then have used that national security state to foment that plan, to finance that plan, and to bring it about, to put their own people in power so that then they can change our society into something that's more controllable.
I'd say more like
the New World Order.
I'd say more like a fascist society where,
right,
of course, everything is secret. The people are not allowed to know anything. And what's most interesting is that as soon as President Bush got into office, he told everybody not to reply to Freedom of Information Act requests, even though that was the law of the land. He told every government employee who would back them up if they violated the law, in essence. And, of course, we can't even find out what was discussed with the Cheney Energy Commission. They won't tell the people. They just stonewall everything. They refuse to. They have records that subpoenaed. They refuse to provide them. So we have a government that is above the law, and that really is very disconcerting at the present time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's secrecy. I mean, we had an event that happened in New York City where 3,000 Americans died, and that event then has been used to take away our rights and to go create war around the world. You know, I mean, this guy claims to be a Christian, and then you know, leads us on a war of revenge, and then leads us our country on a preemptive strike, the first time ever. Against, you know, all kinds of international law and international goodwill. And it's absolutely ridiculous what this person is doing in the name of freedom. You know, he gets on there and says, well, you know, these people don't like freedom, so, you know, we're going to take away your freedom and spend all your money fighting war. And it's just ridiculous, and it's just absurd.
But, you know, the frightening thing to me, Chris, is so many Americans are willing to go along with this. I mean, they should be suspicious that they were lied to about the weapons of mass destruction. But now, of course, we've accepted the fact we went into Iraq because Saddam Hussein was a bad man. Now, there's no question Saddam Hussein was a bad man. But I feel that the people who financed Saddam Hussein and kept him in power are just as responsible as, of course, he was. And people have forgotten that during the Reagan administration, your tax money was used to finance Saddam Hussein. During the first Bush administration, we backed and financed Saddam Hussein right up until the time he attacked Kuwait in 1990. So
and
that
we
was a two-year period.
And we backed him through backdoor deals. I mean, we did it through, like, Department of Agriculture credits and all kinds of different things where we would just give him money to buy one thing, but actually we knew the money was being used to buy weapons and whatnot. And it's just, you know, they just keep playing this game. But, you know, the American population has been subject to propaganda and psychological warfare that was a conscious decision starting in the early 1900s, especially during through World War I and then on up through World War II, so there has been a plan that they don't feel that the American public can be trusted with the truth, and they need to be led with these lies that they tell us and they create, and it even goes down to the level of the television set is not just a medium of entertainment. It is actually a medium of hypnotic control. It runs at 60 cycles per second, and it's not just because of how our electricity is here, but they made it and it has a little flicker. And if you read any book about hypnosis, it'll tell you that a 60-cycle flicker will put a person into a trance so that they are more believable about what comes over that tube.
Well, now, of course, the thing that really disturbs me about what's going on today is the fact that there are people in Washington, D.C., who really believe that the end justifies the means, who do not believe it is important to tell the truth. The important thing to do is to maintain your control. And I believe that they have an objective. I believe that they want to bring about a world government. I think they want to bring about a new world religion. They want to create the impression that we all worship the same God. The Christians and the Jews and the Muslims all worship the same God. And that just isn't true. And I have not been able to determine why our president, who professes to be a Christian, would keep over and over again saying, we all worship the same God, whereas the God of Muslims is the moon god. He's a pagan god, a pagan entity. And yet, of course, the president keeps telling the American people that. And my fear is that they may honestly believe that, which, of course, will be the stepping stone to the creation of this one world religion. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there and you have a question or comment about what we're talking about the secret society, or at least one of the secret societies that dominates America today, and that's Skull and Bones. And I certainly find both Prescott Bush, the grandfather, George Herbert Walker Bush, the head of the CIA, the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the man who really controlled the White House from 1980 until 1992, was a member of Skull and Bones. Now his son is in there. You wonder why we couldn't find anybody else but George Herbert Walker Bush to become President of the United States. And it looks like he may very well be the next president. He's already raised almost $80 million, moving towards $100 million for a re-election campaign. And, of course, what's tragically, so many good people who, unfortunately, are backing the current war effort because, after all, Saddam Hussein was a wicked man. So somehow that makes it justifiable to go to war with him. And yet we have wicked people all throughout the world. Are we to go to war with all of the wicked leaders of the world? That Rome tried that, and we know what happened to Rome when she tried to create a Pax Romana. Well, we're trying to create a Pax Americana, and my fear is that very soon since we're spending money we don't have to conquer nations we don't need to, we may very well lose our freedom. Or as Charles Lindbergh's father had said, those who go overseas to fight for liberty may well find that they've lost their freedom here at home.
$80 million for a job that pays $200,000 a year, you know, and it's very interesting. You look at the presidential elections, you know, beyond the question of electronic voting, but you have four states that provide the largest amount of campaign contributions. Those are California, Texas, Florida, New York. And it's very interesting. You have those, what are the four states that have the largest import of narcotics? Well, those are California, Texas, Florida, New York. And then which four states also have the largest amount of money laundering? And those are California and Texas and Florida and New York. And so you have, you know, the drug trade, which is $60 billion a year, is tied in with that want of the control of the federal government. You had, you know, after 9/11, you had 15 Saudis involved, supposedly with the 19 hijackers. But we went to Afghanistan, and in Afghanistan it was the Taliban, it was the UN had supported, had brought down the poppy production there down to about 10% of what it had been. Right after 9/11, and now that we're in control there, the poppies are up to well over 300% of what they were. And you have Americans with C-130s that were involved with the cocaine trade now running big, large airplanes out of the Tajikistan, out of central, around, you know, Afghanistan there and some of the old Russian republics.
Are you suggesting then that these planes are carrying narcotics out with the full knowledge of our government?
Absolutely.
Now, did your father, he was with the CIA, did he tell you that the CIA was involved in drug smuggling during Vietnam?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he said that's basically what the Vietnam War was about. And I've done research since then, and I'm firmly believe that and have had other people tell me the same thing. And it's because these secret societies, you know, they... opium became the largest thing on the planet in the 1830s, and these secret society families were involved with that. They took that money and then used that to help set up the railroads here and take control of the railroads. And then they used the large amounts of money that they make in the drug trade and use that to destabilize and take over other industries. That's why, you know, what do we have here? Four or five corporations that control almost all the, you know, the news organizations. I mean, we can't, you know, we can't sit and talk about Skull and Bones on national TV. I mean, it's getting talked about a little bit more now because of the internet and because of people like you, Dr. Stan, who keep bringing it up and keep talking about it. And so they have to put some sort of response about it. But generally what they say, oh, well, you know, they're just nothing but a bunch of fraternity boys, or well, it's not really, you don't need a secret society for this corruption. It's just how businessmen corrupt you know, people like Alexandra, she says, well, they're like the Wizard of Oz, and sometimes we need the Wizard of Oz. And they make up, you know, all of these stories and whatnot. But
here is a group of people who have stolen skulls of significant people like Geronimo. Is it Geronimo?
Geronimo, yes.
And they stole it. They have his skull down there. They seem to have an obsession with death and with bones. And the Nazis, they seem to have an obsession with the Nazi paraphernalia. And even Alexandra Robbins reports there's a whole rooms just filled with Nazi swastikas and mm-hmm. paraphernalia. What are these people who are leading our country? What's the relationship to the Nazis? Is this a childhood fling? Or is the fact that, of course, the Skull and Bones originated with a Bavarian secret society back in 1832, And, of course, behind all of this are these occult forces that parallel occult organizations, because the Council on Foreign Relations originated in the occult, and the Masons originated in the occult, and you see these people going back from one organization to another. You find people who are in all sorts of occult organizations. And, of course, the common denominator behind all of the occult organizations is the desire for a new world religion and a new world order. I mean, this is what people have missed. The two of them go together, and isn't it interesting that the president keeps telling us that Christians worship the same God as the Muslims, when, of course, everybody knows that theirs is the moon god and not the God of the Bible? So what is this all about? Are we being prepared for another world religion? Is that what the church growth movement is really all about, and these new programs that they're going to be introducing into our churches across America once we have the little groups there where everybody identifies with the groups? There are so many things that are going on today that the average individual is totally unaware of, but I firmly believe the ultimate goal, a new world order, a new world religion, and the new world order will be led by Satan himself. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, you know, what they're trying to do, you know, is I really don't think they care that much about religion, and they use religion for their own use and for control. And it goes back to, if you look at secret societies, they talk about a thing called synarchism, and synarchism is a societal political esoteric philosophy that was created in the 1800s in France as a sort of a response to anarchy, and synarchy was supposed to be the opposite of anarchy, and where in synarchy everything in man's life is controlled, and those are going to be controlled through the political, the economic, and the religious sphere, and those spheres are going to be in control of the secret societies. And it really seems to be what they're doing, and they manipulate all kinds of things about in the religious and the political and the economic spheres. And so, you know, what it is that I see mostly they're trying to move us for is into a fascist a state, and they will use all kinds of different tricks. I mean, one of the first things they did was to take over education and religious institutions. You look at the early list of Skull and Bones members, and you find a lot of preachers and a lot of teachers. And the education system they brought over was from Prussia. It had been developed. You can read Johann Wolfgang Fichte in his third address to the German people. He says, "We're going to take your children and we're going to teach them what and how and when to think." And they found that if they took the classical education and tore it apart and would take the subjects and teach them for about an hour long and put bells in between, then they could create a false construct around people. And then by moving that construct into influencing the extremes on that construct, they could move society in the way that they wanted to move it. And the things that they had to do was they had to break down religious structures, and they had to break down family structures and get everybody in a little box, thinking that they're just there kind of by themselves. And so they've used the television and the advertisements. They spent a lot of money on group dynamics to find out how the different buttons that they can push on people to move them in different directions, whether it be religious buttons, economic buttons, or whatever buttons it are. Like the people in these secret societies, they promote. There's a great book called The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan, and he's taken into a room and explained some things, and they talk about how they're going to take homosexuality and abortion, and they're going to shoot these like bullets into the psyche of the America of America, because they don't really care about abortion and homosexuality. These are things that happen, and they used those as things to hang the dispute on, so that they can get true believers on both sides to fight each other. And while the true believers fight each other, then they can manipulate things behind the scenes and move history on in the direction that they want it to be moved on to.
Well, now, this book's The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan. Where is that available?
It's hard to get. I saw it available at, I think, Prevailing Winds Institute. It's somewhere on the California coast there. And it was written by a gentleman by the name of Donald Freed.
Well, that isn't that important. I thought you might know offhand, but that's all right. Supposedly Ronald Reagan was told these things. Is this?
Yes. And you can see it in lots of different subjects where they don't really care about. All they care about is they stay in control. I mean, they'll tell us any lie that will work. You know, they don't really care. It's like you say, the ends justifies the means. It's just like, President Bush can sit there and, like I say, call himself a Christian and then do all these unchristian things and continue his lifelong membership in the Order of Skull and Bones, which is anything but a Christian organization. I mean, when you get down to it and look at it, look at Western magical tradition and look at the magic. Well, basically, what these people are is they practice a low-level form of sorcery, what is called nigromancy or necromancy. They believe in the power of death, and they create death. And
now, of course, you're really referring to some of the information that's been made available about their rituals, isn't that, where they all lie in the coffins?
And their rituals, and then you just look at what their symbol is. It's a symbol of death. The totem was the death camp. When you look at the Skull and Bones, it was first used in Prussia in 1740 for a elite group of military people, and then it was used. Hitler used it for the people that watched the death camps.
You're talking now about the symbol of the
right,
skull
the symbol.
And the cross skull,
right.
Cross thigh bones, which is the symbol of the Skull and Bones Society. Chris, we're out of time. I wish we had more time to develop all of these ideas. But look, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I think you'll be with us again sometime next week, one of the afternoon programs.
Well, my pleasure. I'll probably be a little bit more awake. I'll have to admit, sometimes at this time, I'm already in bed asleep.
All right, fine. Well, I'll tell you what. If you're going to do talk shows, you got to get used to being up all sorts of hours. But anyway, God bless you.
You're a hard-working guy, Dr.
Well, Smith. I believe that we need to get this work information out, and hopefully we can progressively expand our audience, and people will come to understand the dark spiritual forces that really threaten the existence of modern-day society. Chris, good night. God bless. We'll talk again next week, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Right, good night. And this is the time we want to remind people that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We do hope many of you will pray for America. You'll pray for our leaders and our ministers. You'll pray for the revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, I don't see that God will ever again bless America. And lastly, we ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until next week at the same time, we'll be back on Monday. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.